Okay. So does my...
Turn what?
Yeah.
John is a doctor.
I could figure it out. I mean, if I had to. If... All right.
Yeah, there you go, John.
You hit the on button. Is that what you did?
I did hit the on button.
Okay.
And let me put this off mute. Yep, got it.
All right. Brilliant. Yeah. Hey, July 4th, we're having a picnic in Merced at Lake Yosemite Park. Y'all are invited. Free food. Come on down starting at 10 o'clock. Yes? Okay, great. So, Ken told me an hour for my talk and then 40 minutes for question and answer. You're willing to stay here until 9:30? Seriously? Okay. Are we going forward here? PowerPoint? Okay, good. So I was asked to teach on science and God and kind of another little thing on science and the Bible. All right. So we're going to consider two possible views about nature, about reality. One would be the determinist slash atheist slash naturalist position. I'll let Thomas Huxley represent that. He said, is there a way to turn on this monitor so I don't have to be looking back all the time? Oh, there. Okay, great. Oh, okay, good. In the universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, others are going to get lucky. You won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties that we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. It just is, and we dance to his music. So that's one perspective. Blind, pitiless indifference. What we observe is the result of random actions with no purpose, no direction. It just happened. All right, as Thomas Huxley said, man was made flesh by a series of singularly beneficial accidents. Thing is, I hang out with these people. I hang out with scientists. I'm a scientist myself. My PhD is in chemical physics. And by the way, it's not like all scientists are atheists, but they're just the loud ones who talk loud and really act as if, well, duh, obviously. Come on, give me a break. All right, and one of the results I want to have from this talk is to not be intimidated by these people. Because the question is that a realistic description of reality? All right, another position would be, let me see here.
I don't think it's working, John.
It's not working. Well, I've got my, clicker if you want to use it.
That's okay.
All right, we're just going to go with it. Okay, great. So another possibility is the idea of design. All right, William Paley invented what's called the watchmaker argument. I'm not going to use a watch example. I need somebody's cell phone. All right, give up your cell phone. Come on, teen.
Yes, do it. Give it to him.
Yeah, I need your cell phone.
Yeah.
Thank you. So imagine, again, William Paley's example was a pocket watch. But nobody has a pocket watch anymore, so we'll use a cell phone. All right. So imagine, you're just walking down the street and you see this thing on the ground. You think, gee, how'd that get there? Maybe a series of singularly beneficial accidents. Maybe random chance. So maybe, there's some glass, some metal, some silicon. Maybe the car ran over it, boom, cell phone. Or is it more likely there was a designer behind that thing? All right. In fact, if you think there's not a designer there, then we have to test your ability to think at all. But I would argue the simplest living thing has more complexity than that cell phone. The simplest living thing has more design to it than that cell phone, because even an E. coli is a nano factory of unimaginable complexity. And yet there's people that believe that it happened, just molecules bump into molecules, there it is. So the question is this, is there evidence for design and nature? Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to hit the button, we're going to pretend it's working, and whenever you see me hit the button, then you hit the button. Make sense? All right, good. See, it works. It's amazing. Let's see if I can fake him out. Oh, all right, you can't. Oh, no. I'm faking you out. All right, now. All right, good. So this is the teleological argument of the existence of God, the argument from design. All right? Or sometimes called the anthropic principle. That's a really fancy term. Is it more of a philosophical term? Which basically says, the only way you can explain reality is to assume there's a purpose behind that reality. In other words, the universe is designed so that we could be here to experience that universe. Alright? In fact, maybe better than a cell phone. Here we go. Thank you very much. Don't use it though during church. Alright? I hear they're talking about banning cell phones in high schools and junior high schools. Can I have a round of applause for that? Very good idea. All right? You guys can use them when you get home. Anyway, maybe a better example. Let's imagine you have a junkyard. All metal and scrap and glass and just a bunch of stuff. And imagine a tornado ripping through there, throwing everything up in the air, and down comes a 757 Dreamliner. That's what we're talking about in nature. So what I'm going to do is, I'm going to do a very brief survey of things that I would teach in a freshman introductory science class, be it chemistry or physics or biochemistry, talking about things that show evidence for design. Because let me tell you my story, if you will. I grew up going to church. I was the guy carrying the cross around and all that kind of stuff. The problem is I was a pot-smoking knucklehead, and I was an atheist, and I didn't believe in God, which didn't seem to matter in that situation. So I go off to college, and I was so proud of being an atheist. I remember taking philosophy, you know, 101 freshman year and thinking, you know, Friedrich Nietzsche said, God is dead. And I said, yeah, that's great. That's awesome stuff. But then through studying physics and chemistry, I decided, wow, this is not just a bunch of random stuff. There is a designer. There is a creator. All right, so what I'm going to do is I'm just going to look at some things I see in just introductory science classes that proves beyond any rational ability to ignore it that there is a designer, there is design, and therefore a designer and then a creator. So here we go. Another. This is the actual one. There you go. So water, you know, H-O-H, right? Hopefully you don't need that label there. That hopefully that would give it away. Shh, yeah, come on. H2O. Alright, you could teach an entire one semester course to explain all the properties that are unique to water. In other words, the properties that water has that no other substance has. And every single one of those properties, if water didn't have those properties, we wouldn't be here. And so I'm going to argue that water is a clearly designed substance. A few things. In order to have life, you have to have a liquid solvent. Life cannot be made out of something that's solid. That doesn't make any sense. Or gaseous. So it has to be a liquid. There aren't that many liquids at room temperature, actually. But water happens to be liquid across most of the temperature range at which life could exist. Because scientists would tell you that life can only exist from about minus 20 degrees to about 80 degrees centigrade. Outside that range, life cannot exist because below that temperature, chemical reactions don't happen. Above that temperature, molecules begin to fall apart. And it just so happens that water is liquid across almost that whole range, but not the whole range. I'll get to that later, the whole thing with ice. Now, another property that it has to have is it has to be able to dissolve a wide range of molecules. In order for life to exist, the liquid, which is the substance within that which that life exists, has to be able to dissolve a wide range of molecules of, excuse the technical language, polar, nonpolar, ionic. Okay? In fact, if that liquid cannot dissolve ionic substances, you couldn't have a nervous system, things like that. But it just so happens, there's only one liquid that dissolves ionic substances in the entire world. It's water. In fact, water dissolves a wider range of substances than any other liquid. Lucky for us, otherwise we wouldn't exist. Luckily, though, water doesn't dissolve everything, because otherwise I'd be a puddle right now, and that would be a problem. Okay, a few other properties that water has. It has a high specific heat. Now, don't mind the technicalities. If you don't understand every detail, you're going to get the picture here. In other words, water absorbs a lot of heat. In fact, water absorbs 10 times more heat than almost any other substance. And the closest substance is less than half the ability to absorb heat of water. Now, it just so happens, the only substance that's a liquid in the right temperature range, that also has the right solvent properties, is also the substance that has by far the highest specific heat. Why is that important? Because if water didn't have such a high specific heat, then the temperature on the earth would go up and down by 200, 300 degrees centigrade in any given year. No life. That's why it's better to live near the coast than in here, right? It gets pretty hot around here because we're far away from the ocean. Okay, but that's not the only interesting property that that water has. Water has this really weird property that the solid floats on top of the liquid. And by the way, there are millions and millions of compounds. There's exactly one compound out of all those millions of compounds where the solid floats on liquid, right? Ice floats on water. So why is that important? Well, it turns out when it's cold, the colder ice floats on top of the warmer water. Otherwise, in the winter, the lakes would freeze to the bottom. And then during ice ages, the oceans would freeze to the bottom. And basically, any advanced life form would no longer exist. But then there's another weird thing about water. Every other substance, if you plot density versus temperature, it goes like that. The only exception is water. Density versus temperature goes like that, and then like that, all right, and then like that. And so what that means is in the winter, the colder water floats on top of the warmer water, because water flips over at about 4 degrees centigrade. Now, again, if you didn't understand exactly what that's about, every single one of these properties that water has, that literally no other substance has that property. The thing is, the same substance has to have all those properties. And do you think that that's just an accident? It's just random chance. Okay? I would say no. And by the way, I could talk about the viscosity of water and a bunch of other things, but that's enough for water. Okay, next slide. Probably that slide gives some of you the willies, or you're starting to sweat and that kind of stuff. The periodic chart. Okay, I tell my students that that chart was invented by Mendeleev, Russian chemist. Actually, I was in Kiev, and I got to give this lecture in the auditorium where Mendeleev used to lecture. It's sort of cool. Anyway, I tell them Mendeleev invented that chart, but actually, I don't think that's true. I say God invented that chart. In fact, God's fingerprints are all over that thing. There are at least 22 elements that I know of which have a property that no other element has. And if that element didn't have that property, we wouldn't be here. I've got a question for the atheist. Why are there so many elements? Not described elements. Why are there so many elements? The answer is because there's a lot of properties that materials have to have in order for life to even function. All right, so let me talk about a few examples. Next slide. Okay, carbon. I teach organic chemistry. When I teach organic chemistry, the first week, I spend the entire week listing all the properties that carbon has that no other element has. And every single one of those properties, if carbon didn't have that property, again, there'd be no life. So carbon is a wonderfully designed element. A few examples. One example is this thing with got the laser thing and all that? Is it one of those laser ones? No. All right. Here's my laser pointer. There's my pointer right there. Okay, one of the properties of carbon is that it forms four bonds. You say, why is that important? Well, it turns out if an element forms a single bond, a double bond, or three bonds, it makes two-dimensional molecules. You have to have four bonds in order to get a three-dimensional molecule. If you don't have three-dimensional molecules, they don't have three-dimensional life. So the central element for life to exist has to form four bonds. By the way, can we go back one slide? Carbon's not the only element that forms four bonds. Also, silicon does. The problem with silicon is if you put two silicon atoms together in the molecule, it explodes, which wouldn't work very well. There's a famous scene in a Star Trek. You're a Star Trek guy, I can tell. There's the famous scene where there's this monster, and Spock goes, oh, very logical, silicon monster, because of the whole four bonds thing. All right, whatever. Okay. Now, another property of carbon is, not only does it form three-dimensional molecules, it's the only element that does this, it's also the only element that forms large molecules, as well as rings. and single, double, and triple bonds, and a bunch of other stuff that you don't really know a whole lot about. The list of properties that carbon has, there's this long list. Every single one of those properties, if carbon didn't have those properties, there'd be no life. So I say, thank you, God, for designing carbon. Next element. What's the next one? I think it might be oxygen? No, iron. Iron has a unique property, and that unique property is this. Iron is the only element that forms a strong magnetic field. All right? Why is that important? Well, it turns out there's this thing called a star. And the design of a star, the whole thing of the design of the star with hydrogen and the fusion and all that kind of stuff, amazing. But, okay, it turns out the main energy that comes from a star is visible light. Lucky for us, because visible light is the only kind of light that can induce chemical reactions without destroying the molecules. And about 90% of the energy from the sun, lucky for us, is in the form of visible light. However, there's two kinds of radiation that comes from the sun that would destroy all life. One of those is the cosmic wind, if you will, the solar wind, the high energy particles. That's what produces the aurora borealis and aurora australis. In fact, one of the biggest problems in going to Mars is you're going to have to design shielding around that capsule. Otherwise, the people in there will be destroyed by the solar radiation. All right, but then iron, which forms a magnetic field, which literally is a force field. The particles come towards the Earth, and they're bent around the Earth by that magnetic field. So thank you, God, for iron having a magnetic properties. But there's another thing about iron, because iron is the most stable nucleus. So guess what the Earth is made out of mostly? Iron. And if the only element that was magnetic wasn't also the most common element, we'd be out of luck anyway. So that's a coincidence. The only element that forms a magnetic field, otherwise we're all wiped out, also is the most stable of all the elements. And the stability of it has to... anyway, I could go on and on about that. And we all know that iron is essential to life, because otherwise, with its magnetic properties, otherwise you couldn't put the kids' homework on the refrigerator. Okay, good. Okay, next slide. Oxygen. Now, the cool thing about oxygen comes in two flavors. O2, that's what we call oxygen, O3, ozone. And both forms of oxygen are absolutely essential for life to exist. First is O2, the one that's common down here where we are, and that's the only substance that supports a high metabolism life, essentially. But then there's another form of ozone, of oxygen, O3, ozone, which is very, very poisonous to human beings, to all animals. Luckily, almost all of it exists in the upper atmosphere, where it blocks the other kind of radiation which would destroy all life, which is ultraviolet radiation. So there's another designed element. Next slide. Okay, we can talk about helium as a designed element, and hydrogen, and nitrogen, etc., but I'm going to talk about uranium. Probably you think uranium is dangerous, right? Because it's radioactive. Actually, it's not as dangerous as you think. I'm not saying keep a chunk of uranium in your bedroom, but actually the reason it's not as dangerous as you think is because it has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, which means it decays over a very, very long time. Lucky for us. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. Because the uranium, and by the way, uranium is very, very dense. So guess where almost all of it is? In the center of the Earth, producing heat. Otherwise, the Earth would be solid all the way down to the middle, in which case we wouldn't have an atmosphere, in which case we wouldn't have plate tectonics, which is this massive recycling system that keeps the minerals required for life recycling over the course of tens and hundreds of millions of years. So there you go. Plate tectonics. Now, if you don't like a planet with a lot of uranium, go to Mars. There's almost no uranium there. And also, almost no atmosphere, no plate tectonics, and sterile surface. There you go.
Why are we going there?
All right. Well, yeah, why are we going to Mars? That's a good question. Ask the people who set the budgets for NASA. All right. So, as a chemist, I say, how could you not see design? Let's talk about biochemistry for a bit, though. I teach biochemistry as well. Actually, I don't anymore. I retired. I just teach the Bible now. But I taught biochemistry quite a few times. And I love teaching biochemistry, just like with organic chemistry, because there's so many times you can just stop and say, wow, that's really cool. And my students kind of figure it out after a while. I'm a believer. So then there's DNA. Okay, you know the G's and the C's and the T's and the A's, adenine, thymine, guanine, cytosine. These are the nucleotides that form DNA. And it turns out a set of three nucleotides is a code, essentially, for an amino acid to form a protein. Now, I'm going to go back and forth. You're going to have to, okay, go forward. All right, go forward. All right. Yeah, the information in the DNA makes these things, these proteins. Go back. All right. Yeah, DNA. Now, here's the thing. The DNA acts as a code. So there's all these different trinucleotides, and a group of three makes an amino acid to make a protein. Here's my question. Could molecules randomly just bouncing around and hitting each other result in producing a code? Does that make any sense at all? Answer is, no, that doesn't make any sense. In fact, I'm gonna tell you that although nature does spontaneously produce order, one thing nature never does spontaneously is create information. That's one of the laws of thermodynamics, essentially. Nature does not spontaneously produce information. All right? I was going to make a comment about disinformation, but that sounds political, so I'm going to move on here. All right, I'm going to move on. All right, how much information are we talking about? Well, in the case of the human genome, around 3 billion of those base pairs. 3 billion, that's the amount of information in a small library. But I want to talk about the earliest, simplest life that existed, such as, say, an E. coli bacteria. 100 million of those pairs. All right, let's cut that down to 50 million. No, let's cut it down to 25 million, which is less information than probably could even support a living thing. The probability that this information could be spontaneously generated would be like taking 25 million letters, throwing them in the air, and when they landed on the ground, you could read them in Afrikaans or whatever language you want. I mean, how many times would it take to throw those 25 million letters into the air so that when they land on the ground, it would make a readable thing? If you believe that could happen, great. Sign up for atheism. Okay? That does not make sense. And I'm telling you, this is a fact. Nature does not naturally produce information. Never mind a 25 million sequence of information that's readable and useful to make a living thing. Now, another thing interesting about DNA is the only thing that makes DNA, next slide, is proteins. But guess what? The only thing that makes proteins is, previous slide, DNA. So you know about the chicken and the egg, right? All right, I'm telling you, the chicken and the egg is nothing compared to this one. Because I ask our friend, say, Dawkins or whatever atheist. So which came first? The DNA or the protein? All right, because here's what you have to believe. What you have to believe is, in some miraculous event, the DNA that would have been produced by the protein sort of accidentally created itself, but at the same time and in the same place, the proteins that would have been made by the DNA also spontaneously appeared, both, and they kind of joined together and you got a living thing. I'm telling you folks, this is craziness. Now, biochemists came up with this whole RNA world. I don't have time to show why that's a ridiculous ad hoc hypothesis. The bottom line is, life was created by an intelligent creator. The evidence for design is absolutely overwhelming. All right, little chemistry, little biochemistry. How about some, you guys like physics? Let's talk a little bit physics, next slide. Okay, yeah, I'm sorry about that. Yeah, nature does create order. Those crystals represent order. Order can be produced spontaneously, next slide, but what can't be produced is information. All right, for example, a house of cards. Imagine taking a pile of, say, 10,000 playing cards and having leaf blower, you know, going, and then this house of cards is assembled spontaneously. Folks, that can't happen. It does not happen. And waiting long enough doesn't solve the problem. All right, next, little physics. All right, before the 1940s, physicists were unanimous, virtually unanimous, in the claim that the universe is eternal. It's called sort of like the steady state hypothesis. All right, now, why do you think physicists were unanimous in this belief that the universe is eternal? Is it because there was evidence that's eternal? No. It's because the alternative is problematic to atheists. Because there's really only two possibilities. The universe has always existed or is created. All right? And so the idea that the universe is eternal was not a scientific idea, and yet it was held to almost religiously by almost all scientists. All right, but in the Bible, Hebrews 11:3, we have, by faith we understand that the universe is created so that what is seen has been made from things that are unseen. Actually, we don't have that by faith anymore. We have that by evidence. All right, because in the late 1920s, Edmund Halley discovered that the universe is expanding very, very rapidly. It's called the redshift. And if the universe is expanding very, very rapidly, that means at one time it was smaller. And then some physicists came up with this crazy idea that maybe it was tiny at one time. And it expanded. And it came up with the idea of the Big Bang. Now, it's not like atheists just folded instantaneously. All right, sure. No. They fought and fought and fought. But then in the 1960s, the microwave background radiation was discovered. And according to the Big Bang model, this event, we call it the Big Bang, should have produced a radiation that fills the universe. It would be in the very long microwave range. And then in 1965, these two radio astronomers were producing a radio antenna, and it picked up this microwave radiation. They're like, broken, maybe a bird pooped on our thing like that. And he was sharing with his cosmologist friend. He said, you just discovered the proof of the Big Bang model. So by the 1960s, physicists finally caught up with the Bible. And here's what I believe it's a unanimous at this point for cosmologists. They believe that there was nothing. No time, no mass, no energy. Even time and space did not exist. And then at one instant, all the matter, all the energy, and space and time itself were created from absolutely nothing. Kind of like Genesis 1:1. God said, let there be light. All right? Now, next slide. As physicists began to investigate the nature of what must have been... By the way, we can't prove that the Big Bang happened. You can't prove it. What do you get? You can't do an experiment, right? And you can't rewind the tape, but what I can say is, as a scientist, all the evidence points towards that event. That's the only model that works. As they began to look at the nature of what this event must have been, they began to notice a few interesting coincidences about creation. And it's created this idea of the finely tuned universe. In other words, there are a number of parameters that define the universe that if you change them by the tiniest amount, the whole thing doesn't work. Alright, it's kind of like when you have an orchestra and the head violinist goes out there, they kind of do this, right? And everybody else kind of tunes in on that thing and they go from there. Alright? But if they're not tuned together, you ever listen to like 8-year-olds doing a, you know, string orchestra? It doesn't sound too good. Alright? It's kind of like that. Anyway, next slide. One example is in the size of the gravity force. Now, gravity is essential to the universe working because gravity is the force that causes matter to collapse to form stars and galaxies and planets. All right? But here's what they discovered about the force of gravity. What they discovered is if the force of gravity is bigger than it actually is by this fraction, the universe would have collapsed almost immediately. 1 part in 10 to the 60th. On the other hand, if the force of gravity was smaller than it is, by roughly this fraction, stars and planets and galaxies would have never formed at all. So two questions for the atheist, the determinist and naturalist. Number one, why does gravity exist? Help me out. Why does gravity exist? I know why. I think I know why. Because without that, we wouldn't be here. And then the next question is, why does gravity just so happen to have the insanely precise value so that life can exist? To give an illustration of how low a probability this is, let's imagine your friend won the big lotto. What would you say? Yeah! Wait a minute, you're a Christian. You gambling? Alright. Let's not get into that theological issue. Alright. Alright. Now imagine the next week they won the big lottery again. And the next week they won it again. They're in jail, right? The probability, again, we have to assume that gravity exists at all. But let's imagine that it does exist. The probability that it would have the right value so that we could be here would be like winning the big lotto 6 weeks in a row. That's kind of like the probability that the atheist is right and it's just an accident. Next slide. But what that doesn't mention is there are over 30 parameters that define kind of how the universe works, which have a similar thing to this. Some of them are tuned to one part in 10 to the 50th. Others only plus or minus 10%, something like that. But if you start multiplying this out, it equals zero, folks. It equals zero. For example, what about the strong nuclear force? The strong nuclear force is what holds the protons and the neutrons together. Protons, positive charge, repel. All right, the strong nuclear force. Now, if that force was 10% larger, then there'd be no hydrogen. And if there was no hydrogen, there'd be no stars. On the other hand, if that force were 10% weaker, there'd be only hydrogen and no other elements. Finely tuned. And again, there's at least 30 parameters, such as the amount of electrons and protons, the amount of matter and antimatter, and many, many other things, all of which you change into them the slightest amount, and we wouldn't exist here. So how do atheists save their philosophy? Well, they invented the idea of the multiverse. You ever heard of that thing? It's the idea that there's an infinite number of universes, and we just happen to live in the right one. What evidence do you have for that? The answer, of course, is none. So, next slide. Fred Hoyle said, a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as chemistry, biochemistry, biology. All right. And so to me, the scientist who doesn't believe in God, I'm thinking, what universe are you living in? All right. Of the most famous intellectual atheist in the mid-20th century, here he is, next slide. Anthony Flew, very handsome guy there. He's a real nerd, all right? Anyway, in about 2003, he announced publicly, I give up. There is a God. There is a creator. In fact, I team taught a science course with an atheist professor at Grossmont College for a number of years, and I kept, you know, because we did a section on science and religion, and one day he comes into my office, kind of grabs me, and shakes me, John, guess what? There's a designer, there's a creator, there's a God. Thank you very much for informing me of that. Okay, next slide. All right, we can talk about the right kind of galaxy, next slide. The right kind, we'll just go through a bunch of slides because this is extra stuff we don't need. Slides, the star location, right kind of star, right kind of planet. All right. So conclusion then. Again, I'm guessing a couple of the science things I said probably went over your head, but you know, it doesn't really matter. The conclusion is absolutely crystal clear. The universe is designed. So, like Paul said, since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities and divine nature have been obvious, being clearly seen, being understood from what is made, so that men are without excuse. And I would say scientists, most of all, without excuse for not believing in God. In fact, it says they willfully choose not to believe. So I say, don't be intimidated by bald men with glasses who look smart. You know what I'm saying? And women, by the way, and women, right? And women. Okay. Okay, next slide. Now, this presentation's in two parts. So the first part is why I, as a scientist, have to conclude that this universe is created by a very powerful and very smart creator. That's a slam dunk. But then the question is, okay, fine. That means I need to go on a religious search, a religious quest, which is what I did, starting in my sophomore, junior year in college. But I was kind of more interested in Hinduism and Eastern religion and all that kind of stuff. So which religion? So part two is going to talk a little bit about science in the Bible. Now, let me tell you a story. I was in a van with 8 or 10 science professors at a conference. We're going from one venue to another. And this lady says, Christianity, what a stupid religion. I can't believe anybody could ever believe it, especially a scientist. She said, for example, did you know in the Bible it says if you wear clothing with two different materials, capital punishment for that? How ridiculous is that? I said, excuse me, the Bible doesn't say that. She said, yes, it does. I saw it at such and such website. Oh, there you go. All right, so I'm in this van with a bunch of science professors, and I pulled out my Bible. Now, could you find that passage? Because you gotta find the passage about wearing clothing with more than one material. Could you find that passage? Now, I knew it was on the right-hand side of the page, about halfway down, somewhere in the about 4 or 5 chapter range in Leviticus, flip, 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 and I read it. All right? Then I said something like this. It's not exact, but something like this. I said, you know, people say the Bible's full of all kinds of science errors. I've read through the Bible several times. I haven't found one yet. I don't know what they're talking about. It got very quiet in that van, and then we just went on and talked about other stuff. Again, don't be intimidated. We happen to be right on this. All right, here's Dallas McCown, another well-known. He's a evolutionist, and he confidently states, Christianity is scientifically unsupported and probably insupportable, philosophically suspect at best, disreputable at worst, and historically fraudulent. The enemies of Christianity say these kind of things with such confidence as if they can somehow cow us into saying, oh, I'm so sorry for believing in the Bible. But my response to this is, all right, historically fraudulent, okay? Can you give me a single fact from history or archaeology which disagrees with what the Bible says? Do you have even one example? No? Then why did you say that? All right, so philosophically suspect, so you're saying, like, naturalism or determinism is a better philosophy, which denies the reality of evil and moral good, and or postmodernism? Seriously? But how about scientifically unsupported and probably insupportable? So let's look at a few things. Next slide. This is the Papyrus Ebers. It's not the whole document, it's just one page. The Papyrus Ebers is a compendium of medical knowledge in Egypt in the mid-second millennium, around 1500 BC. The date is kind of important to my argument, because that's pretty close to when Moses was kind of doing his thing. Got it? All right, and I believe that probably scholars would agree, of all the ancient cultures, probably China and Egypt seem to have the most advanced sort of medical practice. All right, so let's look at some of the prescriptions, next slide, in Papyrus Ebers, all right? Prevent hair from turning gray, anoint it with the blood of a calf, which has been boiled in oil, or the fat of a rattlesnake. What do you think? Okay.
It works.
It works. Yeah, I mean, Ken's been trying it, no wonder. Yeah, okay. All right, next. A mixture of, oh, no, not next slide, thank you. But thank you for, all right. A mixture of 6 fats, namely those of the horse, hippo, crocodile, cat, snake, and ibex to prevent hair loss. Okay, clearly I've not been using that stuff. Now, presumably the purpose of this was to make the man more attracted to the woman. Women, would you be hanging out with somebody who's putting that stuff on their head? We're laughing! But actually, it's kind of sad if you think about it. Next slide. These are some of the prescriptions found in Papyrus Ebers. Lizard's blood, swine's teeth, rotten meat, moisture from pig's ears, excrement, even human excrement as medicine. So you got a little infection, take some of that, it's kind of smeared around over there. Okay. Now, here's the deal though. The average lifespan back in that time was around 20 years. Not because people couldn't live to be 80 or 100, it's because almost everybody died from some sort of infectious disease. Alright, let's go to the next slide. Here's what it says in Exodus 15:26. Basically God says, if you will obey the commands I'm giving you today, you will not have I will not bring on you any of these diseases. So God promises health, a relative health and lack of disease to those who would obey his commands, especially those in the book of Leviticus. Alright, so let's look at some of the laws in Leviticus. These laws have a spiritual meaning, but they also have a medical significance. For example, in Leviticus 11, it mentions several kinds of meat. No, don't eat that kind of meat. And then a few kinds of meat. Yes, okay. For example, pork? Definitely not. Beef? Uh-huh. Shellfish? Out. Fish with scales? Yes. Now, it just so happens that pork is known to contain more than 20 different diseases, a number of which are fatal. Most famous is trichinosis. Okay? Now, with modern health practices, pork is relatively safe. But even then, cook it all the way through, right? But beef is relatively safe, even raw. I was in a restaurant in Venezuela one time, and I speak Spanish well enough, but I didn't know what that stuff was. So I said, just bring me that one. It was a plate of raw beef. And I'm thinking, all right, Leviticus 11, yeah, let's go for it. It was okay. Okay, now what about shellfish, clams, and oysters and lobsters? Many, many diseases. Okay, if you're going to eat shellfish, cook it very thoroughly. But fish with scales, even raw, it's called sushi. Okay? It just so happens that every meat on the don't eat list, relatively healthy, bad for your health, every meat on the okay to eat list is relatively safe. So imagine how many tens of thousands, if not millions of deaths prevented amongst the Jews simply by observing this one command. Now, if this was the only example of a command with fantastic, amazing health implications, if that was the only one, you could say, well, I don't know, just got lucky or something like that. It's just one example. I wouldn't be blown away by that. It just so happens all the other peoples were eating mice and you know, wolves and you know, predators and those things. Okay. Next slide. All right, now here is an ancient Hebrew text about medicine. Not in the Bible, though. Look at this one. The gnat, feeble creature, taking in food but never secreting it. Let me stop right there. Is that true? Is it true that gnats don't poop? No, that's not true. That's a science error right there. Right there. That's a science error. And there are none in the Bible. Not one. I have a good friend. His name is John Clayton. Some of you may have heard of him. If you've been around for quite a while, you might have heard of John Clayton. He's probably the most well-known apologist, if you will, in the churches of Christ. And his parents were just radical philosophical atheists at Columbia University. And he was the most in-your-face atheist you could ever meet. And he was the head of the Indiana Atheist Society. And he was friends with, what's her name, Mary, what's her name, the head atheist in the country. And he was given the assignment. He was writing a book. The title of the book was The Bible, a Book Written by Ignorant People in an Ignorant Age. And in doing his research, guess what he discovered? Yeah, and he became a Christian, and he does talks like this all around the country. Or the gnat, feeble creature, taking food but never secreting it, is specific against the poison of the viper. This kind of thing is what would be in the Bible if it were not inspired by the actual God. All right? I guarantee you. Because there's plenty of medical advice there in the Bible. This stuff would be, but there's none of it there. Next slide. We're going to look at just three or four more examples, and that'll kind of tell the story. All right, this is in Numbers 19. Whoever touches the dead body of anyone will be unclean for 7 days. He must purify himself with the water on the third day and the seventh day, take some hyssop, dip it in the water, sprinkle on the tent, the furnishings, and the people who were there. So what the Bible says is, if somebody has died, anybody that touches that dead body is unclean. Completely separate from everybody for 7 days, and you have to wash with the water, the ashes, and the hyssop, on the first and the seventh day, then finally you can sort of fellowship. So what that means is, whoever prepares the body for the funeral can't even attend the funeral, presumably of their own family member. Why would God tell them that? All right, next slide. This is Ignaz Semmelweis. What kind of parent would call their son Ignaz? I don't know. Ignaz Semmelweis. He is Hungarian. I was teaching this lecture in Hungary, in Budapest, and I said he was Serbian. And by the way, he did live in Serbia for a while. But one of the members said, no, he's actually Hungarian. I said, I'm pretty sure he's Serbian. So next slide, they took me to his house. All right, so he is Hungarian. But he's working in a hospital in Vienna, and it was a woman's hospital. Next slide. And in this hospital, almost 20% of the women that entered the hospital left dead. A death rate of almost 1 in 5. They had this disease, they called it puerperal fever. Alright? And the scientists struggled to explain the nature of puerperal fever. Some said it's because of constipation, bad air, or some said it's because the women are hysterical. Typical male attitude there. Alright? So Ignaz Semmelweis proposed that if you touch a dead body, you're unclean. Because here's what they would do. The doctors would come in the morning into the hospital, examine the women who died, kind of check out what happened, you know, kind of do a little post-mortem, and then proceed immediately up onto the wards and start examining the female patients. You know exactly what we're talking about. So he said, if you touch a dead body, you're unclean. You wash your hands very, very thoroughly with soap and water before you touch any human patients. The death rate went from about 18% down to around 3%. By the way, this is in the 1830s and 40s when the idea of germs was just becoming an actual idea, Louis Pasteur and others. But then some of us says, in fact, let's do this. Even when you touch a live patient, before you touch another live patient, clean yourself very, very carefully with soap and water. And they had all these things for doing that and all this sort of stuff. The death rate went down to less than 0.5%. Because the Bible says when a woman gives birth, she's unclean. And when a woman has her period, she's unclean. Why would God say that? Because everybody knows that God hates women. No. Because he loves them. Because when are women particularly vulnerable to infectious diseases, and you know where it's going to come from, let's change the subject here, okay? Got it? All right, anyway, they should have had a brass band and a celebration, the biggest hero, and instead they fired him. They went back to their old practices. The death rate went back up, and he died of an infection not too long afterwards. Okay, next slide. All right, but let's talk about the actual treatment. The biblical command is to take hyssop, which is a plant, it's like a spice plant, kind of like thyme, hyssop, ash, and water. And if you take hyssop, which is a very oily plant, and mix it with ashes and water, it makes soap. But it turns out oil of hyssop contains roughly 10% of this compound, thymol. Now, I don't know how many organic chemists we have, but you got this little thing here and that thing here. That's called a phenol. And that's one of the main functional groups in organic chemistry. When I teach my organic students about phenols, the first property I mention is phenols are not poisonous to humans, but they're antiseptic. In other words, they kill bacteria. So, the formula that God gave is, if you touch a dead body, you clean yourself and everything you touch with a powerful antibacterial soap on the first and the seventh day. Okay. Makes sense. You know that smell in the hospital? That kind of medicine smell? It's thymol. Okay, next slide. All right, here's another one. This is about infectious skin disease. Not just leprosy, a wide range of skin diseases. Most famously, leprosy, though. As long as he has the infection, he remains unclean. He must live alone, must live outside the camp. What a terrible thing to do to somebody. If you have leprosy, completely separate from all other people till the day you die. How cruel! Quarantine. Prescribed in the Bible for certain diseases. Now, leprosy was the most feared disease in the ancient world. Not because it killed the most people. Cholera killed a lot more people. Malaria killed a lot more people. Typhus killed a lot more people. Next slide. But did kill millions of people. Fear of other diseases taken together can hardly be compared. Next slide. But not for very long. Now leave that slide, please. Thank you very much. Please. Thank you. That's why they're so feared. And they said it's because of the alignment of the planets, or, you know, not eating, eating too much hot food, or all kinds of crazy ideas. And then in the 16th century, either of the 15th century, I can't remember, somewhere in Scandinavia, a group of monks were reading the Old Testament. And they were helping people with leprosy. They said, let's try that. Let's try, when people have leprosy, let's try quarantining them. And within two or three generations, leprosy had virtually disappeared in Europe. There was a time when Europe had as much leprosy as India or anywhere else. Because the bottom line is, it works. Now, here's the thing. One thing I learned from this is, if God gives you a command, if it doesn't make sense to you, do it anyway. All right? Another thing is, these rules had a spiritual meaning, that leprosy is kind of this idea of you know, impurity and these things. The next one, let's look at another one. I think there's two more. Alright, here we go. The life of every creature is in its blood. Leviticus 7:14. That is why I said to the Israelites, you must not eat the blood of any creature because the life of every creature is in its blood. Anyone who eats it must be cut off. Alright, so, basically, what they're saying is the life is in the blood. Now, do you know what the most common medical treatment was in the 18th and 19th centuries for any kind of infectious disease? Bloodletting. Next slide. Bloodletting. So basically, and next slide after that, basically what the proposal was, if you have an infectious disease, the infection is in the blood, so you drain the blood. And it kind of makes sense if you think about it. It's not true, but it kind of makes sense. So medical science says the disease is in the blood. The Bible said the life is in the blood. Who was right? The life is in the blood. That's a very, very bad idea. Start draining out your immune system in order to get rid of infectious disease. Okay, I think there's just one more here. All right, here we go. By the way, this is not in the law of Moses. This is in Genesis. Genesis, this is Abraham. God said to Abraham, for the generations to come, every male among you who is 8 days old must be circumcised. Two questions. Number one, why circumcise males? And number two, why on the eighth day? Well, first of all, why circumcise males under those conditions? Well, most people died back then from some sort of infectious disease, either bacteria or yeast
or viruses.
All three thrive whether it's warm, wet, and dark. All right. Where's the warmest, wettest, darkest place on a guy? Okay.
Next slide.
Yeah. All right. And the thing is, it was mainly the lives of women that were saved. Now, by the way, today it's a different situation, okay? Whether male children should be circumcised or not, it's not a religious issue because we're not under the Old Testament, right? And the medical advantage of circumcision is, it's somewhat debatable today because you guys take showers. Okay? Yes? All right. So I'm not here to push male circumcision necessarily, but I'll tell you this fact, that the rate of AIDS passing from male to female is reduced by about 60% when the men have been circumcised. All right, so that's a pretty sure preventative for AIDS spreading. But actually, I've got another biblical mandate that would prevent AIDS entirely. One man, one woman for life. All right, that would work. All right, now why the eighth day? Well, I've got an idea. By the way, God didn't say why the life is in the blood. He didn't say why the quarantine. He didn't mention that it's actually Hansen's disease, which is a bacterial disease. He didn't mention any of that stuff. He just says, do it, all right? And then you'll have none of these diseases. All right, why the eighth day? Well, I'm not sure, but the fact is this, that vitamin K does not pass from mother to baby in the womb. It doesn't go through the placenta. And vitamin K is essential in order for the body to form this protein called prothrombin. Prothrombin is the protein that actually creates the blood clot. So when a baby is born, they have low levels of prothrombin, but then it goes actually down for a while because there's no vitamin K. And then baby eats from mommy, gets bacteria in the colon. That bacteria produces vitamin K. The body starts to make prothrombin. The prothrombin level goes up to unnaturally high levels, and then it levels off. Okay, got it? Now I'm going to show you a graph of prothrombin level versus time. Okay? You can see what we're talking about here. From the moment a male child is born until the day they die, what would be the most advisable date to perform a male circumcision? Eighth day, within the experimental era, day 7 and day 9 would be roughly the same. Okay, by the way, again, whether you choose to circumcise your male child, I believe the health implications are much less today, not zero, less. All right, but they generally do it on the first day. You know why? Because when they're born, they give them a shot of vitamin K. There you go. Problem solved. All right, next slide. All right, now, how did Abraham figure this out? I know what he did was a double-blind experiment. So for the next 5 years, we'll do all the circumcisions on the first day, and then the third day. That's a joke. Okay, that's a joke. It's a joke. All right, so I'm basically done. Let's see, what's the next slide? I can't remember, honestly. All right, yeah. By the way, I believe that there's a creator. And I believe to not believe so, it's evidence of irrational thinking. You're kidding me. You see the scientists, the periodic chart, the properties of water, all these elements, the fine-tuning of the universe. You don't believe it's created? What's wrong with you? But I also believe science leads to the conclusion that the Bible specifically is written by that same God. However, my belief that the Bible is inspired is not primarily from scientific evidence. In fact, when I came to believe the Bible is inspired, it had nothing to do with any of this evidence I presented tonight. I came to believe the Bible is inspired by looking at those prophecies that God fulfilled and looking at the miracles that Jesus did. Many, many other reasons I believe the Bible is inspired by that creator. Anyway, so that's our talk, and we're going to do Q&A?
Yes.
Yes? What's that?
Let me grab the mic behind you.
Right? There you go.
All right.
The question could be related to science, or, you know, I teach a bunch of stuff. You could ask a Bible question, a theology question, if you want.
Okay.
Related to the topic or not.
About sex in the Bible. Any science in the Bible?
All right, that's Song of Songs, if you want to talk about sex in the Bible. I'm going to be preaching a sermon from Song of Songs in a little couple weeks. Okay.
It's not actually about this particular presentation.
Sure.
And I know there's a brother who gave a presentation about the Ice Age and dinosaurs and carbon dating, but I wasn't there. So how do you explain the differences between what the Bible says about the time we were created and dinosaurs, millions of years, etc.
So, by the way, carbon dating is irrelevant to this question because carbon dating is only useful for things that are a few thousand years old. Probably what you mean is uranium-thorium-lead dating, which can be used to measure the age of things tens of millions or hundreds of millions of years old. Okay, good. So there are two possible ways to think about those days in Genesis. We could take the Genesis story as basically Genesis 1 is a treatise about God. It's a story about who God is. And it's a polemic against the other view of God that was held in the, you know, Sumerian and Babylonian culture. All right? So one possible explanation is those days are a metaphorical picture. In other words, basically God's saying, the first day, first God did this, and then next God did this, and next God did this, etc. In fact, in the early church, Origen, Clement of Alexandria, those were early church theologians who took that interpretation. Not all did. Some believe the days were literal. Augustine believed they were literal. It was a debate in the early church. There was no way to settle it. All right, but the evidence for the earth being old is pretty strong. All right. For example, let's say we look through a telescope at a galaxy that's 1 billion light years away. Good. So the light that's coming through that telescope into your eye, how long ago did it presumably leave that galaxy? A billion years ago. So if the universe is only a few thousand years old, my question is, does that galaxy even exist? Now, I believe the young Earth position is a perfectly tenable position. Let me explain what I mean by that. So I teach an intro to science class. We talk about science and religion. And in my class, I'd have a lot of young earthers in my class. East County, San Diego, a lot of them. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to stop speaking as a scientist right now. I literally walk across the stage. So I'm going to walk over there. I'm going to talk as a theologian for a minute. So I literally just walk across. I say, all right, let's look at it from a theological perspective. Let's assume as a working premise that there exists an omnipotent, all-powerful creator. Let's take that as a premise. Under that premise, could that creator create the universe, the earth, and everything so that it appears old at the instant it was created? Yeah! Obviously could. So if that kind of God exists, the question is that what happened or not? I come back over here, I say, yeah, all right, but please don't claim, please don't claim the earth appears young. So that's the thing. People go out saying, oh, you know, what about those man dinosaur tracks and all? Folks! I mean, John the Baptist said God could create children of Abraham from these stones. I believe it. I believe God could do that. And this is not a essential theological question. However, don't tell me if the universe is only a few thousand years old that dinosaurs ever lived, because that doesn't make any sense. Okay, you go to the Grand Canyon. I don't know. I don't know how long it would take for that river to dig out that canyon, but it's not 5,000 years, I'll tell you that right now. And there's millions of layers. Where do those layers all come from? And you got sedimentary rock, which are sideways. What, how did that happen? Alright, so, all the evidence points to the earth being a few billion years old, around 4.5 billion years old. It's not just uranium thorium lead dating, it's the distance from the earth to the moon. There's several other parameters we can use. All right, the age of meteorites and things like that. All right, however, I'm not committed to the idea of what the day-age theory. I'm not committed to that. All right, you can believe what you choose. Okay? But I'll be honest with you. I'll just tell you right now. In my opinion, those days represent the things that God did over time. And it works. All right, first God created the earth, and then the seas, and he separated the land from the sea, then he put life in the water, then life on the land, last of all human beings. The basic picture is preserved in reality, but the details, the day, I believe is, those are not literal 24-hour days. Like I said, I'm not committed to that position, I'm not gonna argue with people over that. If you say that those days are literal, great, awesome, amen, I appreciate your faith, but don't try to claim that the earth appears young. Because it just flat out doesn't. Okay?
Yeah, what do you mean when you said that nature cannot create information? I don't understand.
All right. So scientists have this idea of abiogenesis. In other words, life coming from non-life. So they have to come up with a model, right? They have to create a model by which this could happen. Otherwise, they can't really talk about it. But every model they've used involves putting information in. So they'll put a certain amount of information in. It turns out if you put a certain amount of information in, you can then spin it around and the amount of information grows over time. But if you start with no information, you get no information. Alright, and so, let's say I had the numbers 1 through 10. If I throw them up and have them land on the ground, eventually, if I do it, I think it's 100 times, I'll get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. It depends. Anyway, that's permutations and combinations. But I'm telling you, that's not information. All right, information is H-E-S-A-I-D, T-H-A-T, S-H-E-I-S, that's information. And nature does not produce information spontaneously. End of story. There's no countervening evidence or theories. And yet, life has an unimaginable amount of information in order to reproduce. So therefore, essentially it's been proved already that life was created by an intelligent creator.
Not by chance.
Right. So in my book, Is There a God?, when I did a second version of it, I did a whole chapter to kind of talk about that thermodynamics stuff. Big words in there. You can skip that last chapter if you want. Yes?
So I had a question. Do you know where, I guess what I'm trying to understand, when you're talking to an atheist or whatever, and they believe in the science, do you know where they decide?
Okay.
Because I remember reading about Lee Strobel, and he did the whole case for Christ thing, and there was a point where he decided he can't prove no more.
Okay.
And so I'm curious, you've talked to other people that have probably come from that kind of background, but is there a tipping point where they go, where does the, I don't know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Like a scientist.
It's hard for me to answer that question for a few reasons. Number one, I think you should ask that person. The person who doesn't believe in God, I think they should speak for themselves. I mean, I'm tempted to say, because they're prideful and they don't want to admit that there's a God, and therefore they have to submit to that God. Well, that's easy for me to say, but who am I? It's not my place to speak for that person. All right? So I would say, that those of us who think that we're principally logical persons are completely wrong. That we are governed by our emotions, that our emotions trump our minds in most cases. And therefore, I believe there's an emotional, not a factual basis for their lack of belief. However, there's a wide range of things. A lot of people, I was talking on campus yesterday, I shared my faith today on campus. This one girl, she said, you know, I'm really struggling with belief because, you know, my mother is super religious and she did X, Y, and Z, and my father's super religious and he did all this stuff. You know, so it's that kind of stuff. So, bad behavior by Christians is one reason people don't believe. But put it this way, it's not because of a reasoned analysis of the information. It's not for that reason. I'll give another story. I was watching a BBC program, and it was like intellectuals on stage or whatever, something like that. And so what it was is they had a panel of smart people, and they'd bring in experts to defend opposing positions. So the particular subject was, is there a God or not? So they had a theist and an atheist. And the atheist comes out, he's a chemist, he's like very, you know, like, so obvious, you know, why are we even here? Seriously, it's ridiculous, but okay, fine. So they ask him to give his position. He says, the only things that are real are things that can be measured and observed. Other things are simply not real. He says it with such confidence. And then one of the panelists asks him, well, how do you know that? He said, well, those Muslims and those Christians, they're fundamentalists, blah, 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 all the stuff they did. And they stopped and said, sir, we asked you a question. You made this confident statement that the only things that are real are things that can be observed. We asked you why you believe that. Blah, 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 the religion, this, blah, blah, blah. Second time, sir, we asked the questions, you answer them. We asked you why. If you're not going to answer that question, please leave. And he said, I guess I just believe it. So that's why. He based his entire life's philosophy on, well, that's just what I believe. All right, but the question that you're asking is, why did he believe that? I'd say not because of the evidence, that's for sure. Right. You'd have to talk to him, though. I can't answer that question. Like I said, I was supposedly an atheist. Whether I really was one, I think it was more out of rebellion against my parents than anything. Yeah. But, did I have a defense to that belief? No, it's just what I chose as my position. Yes, question.
Thank you, Dr. Olson. I got a question regarding Genesis. I really believe in the Word of God, but I sometimes I don't see in my mind the explanation. I totally believe there might be something I'm missing. So my question has to do with what's the measurement that the Bible uses when it talks about the first and the third day that it was creation made? Because in my mind, and according to the Bible, on the fourth day was when all the stars and the
all right, yeah, good question.
And the moon was created, yet on the third day it talks about it was evening and it was night.
Right. Now, the Bible does not say the sun, the moon, and the stars were created on the fourth day. What does it say? It says these objects appeared in the sky. Okay? Now I've got a question. This is a trick question, but it's an actual question as well as a trick question. If you were on the surface of Venus, how often would you see the sun? Never. How often would you see any heavenly object? Never. Because the atmosphere was too thick. Now, again, whether the scientific models of the early Earth's atmosphere are correct or not, we can debate that, but there's rock formations, we can talk about the formation of hydrates and all this, there's this stuff. But the bottom line is, according to the scientific models, the very early Earth's atmosphere had a lot of ammonia and methane and hydrocarbons, so that the heavenly objects would have been invisible. Then life appeared on the Earth, and then it literally began to literally eat the atmosphere. And eventually, light-absorbing plants started putting oxygen in the atmosphere and nitrogen in the atmosphere. Virtually all the methane and all these other compounds. And so eventually you could actually see the sun and the moon and the stars. So that's my, now that sounds a little bit like an ad hoc hypothesis, to be honest with you. It's a hypothesis that kind of saves my conclusion, but it makes scientific sense. So because we already had day and night on the first day. Why? Because the earth is rotating and the sun is there. They have day and night on Venus, by the way. They have day and night on Venus, but what they don't have is sun and moon and stars. So that's my explanation of why the heavenly objects appeared in the sky on the fourth day. Okay? Yeah.
Hey, John. So I definitely relate to that concept of really bar of faith, where God grew up in the kingdom and then went off to college. Like, I don't believe what my parents believe. That's crazy. Eventually coming back, taking time for myself to actually study it out and get baptized. So my question to you is, from your perspective, how would you go about teaching, as parents, and eventually I want to be a parent, is teaching kids to not only that, the scriptural things, but also things that you're teaching them, like, hey, this is the awesomeness of the world, and so just from your perspective, how would you go about teaching that to your kids?
All right. You're not asking an expert on that subject, you're asking a person, I'm Joe Christian out there, no better than anybody else at that. In fact, of my three children, only two of them have been baptized. And one of the ones who's been baptized is not a faithful Christian. So I'm not here to give you the answer to that question, honestly. I'll give you a generic answer as a person with a lot of experience. I'd say the best thing you do if you want your kids to become a Christian is to be a Christian. And talk is good, but action, it speaks a lot louder than that. So honestly, you should ask somebody who's done a... who's better at this than I am. I'm just being real with you. Alright, but what's the saying in Proverbs? Train a child the way that he or she should go and they'll not depart from it. But that's not a promise. That's more of a principle than a promise. So I would say read the Bible and do what it says, and you dramatically increase the chances your kids will become Christian, but I'm telling you, there is not a guarantee. But I would say this, it's when your kids get to the teenage years, then you gotta go through that whole conversion process all over again. It's like you weren't even a Christian yet, and you gotta humble yourself out and repent. Because the changes you made when you were a baby Christian don't help them at all. Because to you, you were practically like this perfect Christian to them all along. So now they're in the teenage years, they need to see you being open, changing, growing, becoming more like Christ. So the best thing to do is remain relatively unrighteous as a Christian. Just kidding. No. I don't have a good answer for you. I am not standing here as an expert in that area.
This is okay. In a world where science is continuously progressing and everything is becoming more and more science, or proven with science, do you find that more and more people are going to start believing in science and going into atheism, or do you find that more people are wanting to have an open heart about following God and what God provided for us?
All right, well, let me kind of trace the history of the relationship between science and Christianity. All right, so basically, if it were not for Christianity, there would be nothing that we call science. Roger Bacon, 13th century, a philosopher and a theologian, he decided that there is one God who is the creator of everything and unchanging. So he decided the universe must be governed by laws that are universal and unchanging, and he proposed the scientific method as a means to discover those laws, and sure enough, all right, Copernicus, Galileo, and so this method that was discovered based on assumption about the universe that came directly from the Bible created this process that we call science. But then by the 17th century with Isaac Newton began to propose the idea of what's called the mechanical universe. He proposed that, yes, there was a creator who created everything, but that creator is not directly involved. That creator is separate and removed. So the earth, the universe operates kind of like a machine. And he essentially removed God from science. And to this day, that's how science works. So science is the study of natural processes. And those are processes which proceed naturally, the way God intended. So as scientists, we do not invoke God. It's kind of ruled out by the very nature of what we do. Then, by the 19th century, some scientists began to say, we don't even need God anymore. Simon Laplace wrote a treatise describing Newton's physics, and when he gave it to Napoleon Bonaparte, Napoleon said, asked him, where's God in this thing? He says, I don't need that hypothesis. So, by the 19th century, science, which had been produced by Christianity, began for some people to be an excuse to reject the idea of God. All right? So is science good or bad for Christianity? I don't know. I'm not sure about that. But clearly the trajectory is not towards Christianity in America today. We've reached the post-Christian age. Is science the principal reason that we've reached this thing called the post-Christian age? It's part of it. I'm not sure how we got to where we are, what I can do about that. But I do believe that we should not be intimidated by those who use science as a means to somehow say we don't need God anymore. I'm not sure if I answered your question. I kind of went away from your question a little bit. Was there a part of your question I have not addressed, or... Yeah, I would say, because I'm telling you, I spend a lot of time on campus. In fact, I've gotten about 500 phone numbers and emails in the last 2 years. So that means, you know, you got 10 to 1, you got to share with 10 people. So I've shared with 5,000, 10,000 students in the last couple of years. And what I've found is that it's not so much that they're not interested in God or religion. They're looking for a postmodern sort of thing. Which is, you know, they call them the nuns, not N-U-N, but N-O-N-E. So the thing that's growing the most is the nuns. In other words, these are people who believe in kind of a spirituality, but not in a specific religion. And so, arguably, that's our enemy, is that. So, I mean, put it this way. When I became a Christian 45 years ago, a large majority of the college students knew at least a little bit about the Bible, probably accepted the idea of the Bible having authority. Today, that is less than half. And the curve is going in the wrong direction. I'm just telling you the truth. We're in a post-Christian age. But on the other hand, let me encourage you with this. I would say the situation in Rome in the first century was way worse. Way worse. And look what happened. So, if you look at it from the sort of the trajectory of the sort of spiritual and intellectual thing, it could be kind of depressing.
John, one more.
Yep. All right.
So, when we were covering the periodic table earlier, I noticed like some of them were like color coded. I think, does that mean they're like separated into different categories, like liquid, gas, solid, something like that?
All right, now that's not very important to our talk tonight, but it turns out, basically, there's these things called quantum numbers and all that sort of stuff, and depending on the quantum numbers, that determines the properties of the elements. But here's the question, where did quantum numbers come from? In fact, where did wave functions and where did all that come from? I'm telling you, it came from God. Anyway, I can talk about chemistry if you want. We can talk about 1s1, 2s2. 3P6, anybody? 4D, you know, all that sort of, yeah. It has to do with those quantum numbers, which, yeah. So the periodic chart is organized. By the way, the chart was discovered, and then 100 years later, they discovered the quantum numbers. So the fact was discovered, the explanation, about 80 years later, the explanation came. So it's sort of a cool story. Mendeleev had no idea why those elements were formed the way they were.
Well,
okay.
One last question. It's from a friend of mine. His name is LB. Are dinosaurs real?
Yes, but there are no more left around. Dinosaurs disappeared about 65 million years ago. The Chicxulub asteroid wiped them out.
All right. All right, let's give John a round of applause. And John, we got a little something for you.
All right.
It's
I collect Starbucks mugs. Yeah. Sacramento mugs.
Yes, they are.
Awesome.
Right. Yeah. Awesome. Guys, it's 9 o'clock. We're dismissed. Have a great time.
Thanks, everybody. All right.
That was awesome.
That was a lot of fun.
Takes some energy.
You look so familiar. By chance, were you in New Mexico last year?
I was in Toluca about 3 years ago. No, maybe 2 years ago.
You have a doppelganger who talks about science too. My first trip.
What's his name?
I can't remember.
What city?
It's written in my book. We were in, Los Alamos.
I thought you said Mexico.
Oh, New Mexico.
Oh yeah, I spoke in Los Alamos.
About last year.
Last October.
Yeah. Pretty sure.
That was me.
That was my first sermon.
Oh really?
Yeah.
First sermon ever.
Yeah.
And you're a Christian now.
I am.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome.
I'm pretty sure he's the one that.
What did I speak about? I don't. Was it Acts chapter 20?
It wasn't Acts. I just have to.
Acts 20.
But I'm like, you sound.
Wow. Were you at the government lab there?
Huh? Oh no, the boys were. Started here at this church, and then they moved into Mexico. They work at the lab there. So when you started talking about uranium, I was like, I think it's him. But yes, they're there.
Yeah.
I went there. They got
me. Did you want to buy that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll go back there now.
But just wanted to double check that.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for the presentation.
You're welcome. Anybody want a book?
Okay.
Want a book? Okay.
All
right, great. It's 50, that's way too much, 15. $12 each.
Yeah.
It says $15. I refuse to charge $15 for that book.
Oh,
thank you.
Did you accept Venmo? Or
yeah, Venmo.
Oh,
yeah.
Venmo, okay.
John-Oaks-9.
There you go. Okay, so there's two.
Great.
This one I like.
I got a question.
Yeah.
If God is order, is God entropy also?
I didn't say God is order. God created order, though. Right. So basically, Genesis 1 is the story of God creating order out of chaos. That's the main theme of Genesis 1. No, John Oaks 9. Get rid of the 47 and put 9 in there. A 9 in there instead. That's me. Great.
And then how much is this for?
12 each.
Okay, for 24?
Yeah. Yeah, so entropy is chaos or disorder.
Yeah. I guess it's the force of the universe that we create.
Yeah.
What is your 4 digits of the phone number?
Thank you. 15.
Oh, sorry. Thank you for coming over.
Sure.
Thank you.
You're welcome. This is my new book, just published.
Did they get signed?
Huh?
Did they get signed?
I didn't sign. I didn't write that one. I'm a good friend of Marvin Lucas. He and his wife are in the Reno church now.
Okay.
But I don't sign books that I didn't write.
So which one is a good book that you wrote?
From Shadows to Reality is my favorite one.
Yeah.
Yes. The book on Hebrews is good. This is 80 Bible talks.
Yeah, I got it.
History of Christianity. A book on Daniel. The one on Hebrews is great. Not that one though. That's in Spanish.
Yeah. So what do you think about
What do you think about the source Answers on Genesis?
The what?
The resource for Answers on Genesis. Do you know of Answers on Genesis? It's like a Christian-based kind of
I think they're a young earth.
I guess they are, because, I'm wanting to get answers for my children.
Send them to my website instead.
Or I think I was watching a documentary.
Did you want to get those books?
Yes.
All right.
Yes. And then do you have
Venmo, yeah. So let me figure a price. Yeah. I'm going to give you like 20% off here.
Okay, thanks.
All right.
Because she's buying your whole table.
15... 27, 42, 57, 77, 92, this is Spanish, 92, 107, 122, 137, 152, 10% off. So, $137. John Oaks 9. That's me.
Let me
check. Yeah, that's me. So, $137.
I'll just make it 140.
All right, great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Wow, you're a very good customer. Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you. Four volume set. Volume 1, 3, and 4. And there's also volume... There's also volume 2, but I didn't bring a copy with me. This is the first 4.5 centuries. This is the Middle Ages. This is the time of the Reformation. This is from 1750 till now.
My husband's still not a disciple. I want to get this.
That's a brand new one.
Can I bend for you?
Yeah. Okay. $15. What's that?
Venmo.
John Oaks 9.
John.
Dash.
A dash. Dash.
Oaks, O-A-K-S. O-A-K-S. Dash.
Dash.
9.
Come again,
that's me, yep.
There you go. Okay, 15.
Yeah. Thanks.
I have relatives there in Merced.
You do?
Yeah.
So you should have.
You've
been there for 2 years.
2 years? Right. Yeah. So I have to keep in touch with them. I need to, like, see. Okay, I send the payment. Okay, got it. All right. Thank you. All right, so I can, like, I have to connect with them. It's been a long time.
What you could do is you could come down for our July 4th picnic and invite them. Go to our website.
Okay, I'll go there.
It's mercedchurch.org.
Okay.
And it's at Lake Yosemite Park.
Okay.
It's a great location.
I was telling my husband, I wanted something
for
something. Okay.
Yeah, you can introduce Jan and I to them. What's your name?
Noemi. Noemi.
Noemi.
Yes.
Spanish for, yeah.
Yeah, it's a Filipino.
Yeah, okay. 15.
That's a good one.
Thank you. I'll sign it.
Hopefully this will help my oldest son. Because my son.
That'd be good, yeah.
Just, she said the nuns.
Yeah. That might help.
The question is, who made God?
How old is your son?
He's
what?
26.
Oh, okay. His opinion is more set, maybe, but he can change. Yeah.
But he's a Christian.
Another book I would suggest is called Near Christianity by C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis, Near Christianity.
He's been attending church since he was born.
All right.
And then when he came here in the States, he reads a lot of things, and maybe when he just knew some other religion, that's why he's questioning.
You're from Manila?
I'm from Cebu.
I've been to Cebu.
Yeah, that's what I always have.
Yeah. Very good. All right. Good meeting you. Yeah.
Thanks.
Sure.
Okay, yeah.
I talked to him about, like, it is a travel.
You feel right before?
Thank you, John.
Oh, you're welcome.